Methodology Minutes is brought to you by the Methodology Center at Penn State.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Methodology Minutes. I'm Aaron, your host. With me today is Ashton Verdery, Assistant Professor of Sociology and Demography at Penn State. He's also an affiliate of the Population Research Institute, the Institute for Cyber Science, and the Justice Center for Research here at Penn State. Ashton, thanks a lot for sitting down.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Just to kind of ground everybody in what we're talking about, your research is on social network analysis. What are social networks and what is the purpose of analyzing them?
Social networks are typically conceived as the connections between people, and they can be really diversely defined. You can look at connections between people in terms of who has sex with one another, or you can look at connections between people in terms of who just speaks to one another, or kind of more durable connections like who's family members, or who, in academic settings, who co-authors with one another. And really, you can define it sort of through any kind of relational event that occurs between sets of people. And social networks as a field is often interested in those kind of individual level or kind of dyadic level connections between people, but also how those aggregate up into kind of broader constellations of connections. A really classic example is the small worlds phenomenon, this idea that if I know you and you know someone else, that there's only a few steps between me and other people, and that, you know, if you think on a kind of global scale, there's only maybe a few steps between you and a person that is a farmer in Nigeria, or between yourself and the, you know, the president of Japan or something, through these kind of acquaintanceship and things like that.
Yeah, the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon phenomenon.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that kind of phenomenon is often replicated through these kind of acquaintance networks, but we see similar kinds of things in other sorts of networks sometimes. For instance, drug injection networks or sexual networks. When you think of, you know, a few steps away from you in terms of needle sharing in a drug network, or sex in a dating network, you might be able to reach hundreds or thousands of people. And so those are sort of properties of social networks that are often interesting to people. And I think one of the main reasons that we are motivated to kind of study it is these kind of connections that typically are unseen, or at least like not traditionally recorded with traditional data collection instruments, can have a huge like predictive validity or capacity to kind of tell us about what people's behaviors are, and also to kind of tell us about how the broader environment structures like individual decision-making and risk. Back to the kind of injection drug network, there's clearly very different risks of like an outbreak of hepatitis C or other kinds of severe infections in a network where, you know, people inject with other people, but there's no kind of broader connectivity. Whereas in a network where there is that broader connectivity, where maybe a few steps away from you, you can reach 2,000 people or something like that, you're at much higher risk of contracting bloodborne infections and pathogens. And, you know, similar ideas can kind of be woven back to sorts of health behaviors and information that we get about, say, for instance, migrants, information that migrants would get about opportunities to find jobs in a destination. Those kinds of broader connectivity structures really transmit and constrain sort of the information that's available to us in these important ways. And so social network analysis is often about kind of formally studying the connections between people and how they aggregate up into these kind of broader structures that can have huge importance for all sorts of activities.
Thanks. So what brought you to the study of social networks on a personal level?
On a personal level, I guess there's sort of two ways to answer it. One is I've always sort of been interested in social sciences, like revealing these unseen behaviors or unseen kind of patterns to human activity. The idea that with a few variables, you can predict someone's likelihood of going to college or their income when they're older kind of fascinated me in undergraduate years. And social networks, I think, are a really nice analogy towards this idea that there are these kind of unseen patterns that kind of structure our lives. And so like by measuring and analyzing those things, we can come up with better predictions or better understandings of human behavior has always been really fascinating to me. I guess on a more personal level, you know, I was in college right around when Facebook was like booming as a kind of entity. You know, it was only available to college students then. And I remember, I was thinking it was like freshman year or sophomore year, became available at my university. I thought, this is so cool. And then you could click through and see like, oh, like this person that I have a class with knows this other person who's friends with someone else, that sort of small world phenomenon. did really just kind of fascinate me on a visceral level that I think connected these more theoretical ideas of these connections between people and such to actual data in a way that you could see the connections that otherwise are very difficult to see, and you need special survey instruments. But Facebook kind of made that appealing and visible to, you know, any undergraduate in the United States in 2005 or something, or in Canada where I was. So that really connected with me too. So I think the twin influence of this, like seeing the unseen patterns and then like having a really staggering example of it as a very popular entity at that time was very interesting to me. I do want to be clear that social network analysis is not just looking at Facebook data. It's a common mistake, but it definitely was an impetus in sort of my interest in the topic.
Yeah, that's really neat. So you've touched on this a little bit, but other than understanding, say, the risk of a network of injection drug users, why is social network analysis valuable for people who research behavioral health issues like drug abuse or HIV?
There are really two principal reasons, in addition to the kind of broader risk network. One, who we interact with is one of the most fundamental parts of our lives, like as social creatures, and who we turn to for support and assistance with problems is a really critical part of how we navigate things like drug addiction or rehab and treatment and things like that. And so in addition to kind of the bloodborne epidemiological issues, there are real sociological issues about coping with the challenges of, you know, drug use, coping with, you know, having support to go into rehab and stay in rehab. And then, you know, the flip side of it, of people that maybe drag you back into the scene or something like that. So there's a lot of reasons to study it from like that perspective. The other flip side of why it's very useful, it happens to be a very effective way of recruiting individuals into kind of samples from these populations. People who use drugs and people at high risk of HIV tend to be some of the hardest people to survey through kind of traditional methods. Most social science surveys historically have kind of been either someone knocks on your door and says, hi, I've got a survey and I'd like you to take it, or they'll mail it to you, or they'll phone you at random or something like that. And those are increasingly ineffective methods for reaching general population members, but particularly populations that are highly stigmatized or at high risk of HIV tend to be very reluctant to participate in these kinds of things because their behavior is sometimes illegal in the country where they're engaged in it. They don't want their membership in that population to be broadly known. Or even just from a practical standpoint, you know, where do you get a list of all the drug users? You know, mm-hmm. You might have a list of people who attended a treatment clinic, but that's a very select group of drug users versus, you know, the kind of broader community. And so one of the methods that's been found incredibly effective at recruiting these populations over many decades, but particularly since the 2000s, is asking individuals who are in the population to refer others that they know that are in the population. And that is, you know, fundamentally a social network process. It relies on these social network connections between people. And often, because these populations are structured in that sort of small worldy way, where through a few ties you can reach a large number of people, it's a very effective way to kind of move through the network and engage large numbers of people. The challenge with that is traditional sampling protocols or traditional survey statistics assume that you don't do that. Mm-hmm. And so you need some method to kind of account for that recruitment process versus randomly knocking on doors. And so an additional kind of benefit of social network analysis within studying these groups is it provides some ways and insights to kind of account for that sampling process and create estimates that generalize to the population of interest rather than ignoring that you recruited people that way.
Thanks. Another population that is hard to reach that you've worked on are migrants. And migrant issues have been much in the news recently as the nation's immigration policies have changed. Does your work suggest anything about the impacts that policies changes have to migrants' ties and migrants' social networks?
So my research on migrants focuses on kind of migrant connections to other people, including non-migrants in the destination and people back home, as well as migrants in the destination. And one of our main questions is, now that migrants can communicate so easily with, you know, across borders and cell phone rates are very low, are migrants maintaining ties to the origin? And if they are, what are the ties that they're maintaining? Going beyond just kind of individual questions of like, do people mostly talk to their children or their parents or something like that? There are questions about within a kind of broader migrant community, how is the structure of the community connected through these kind of ties that people engage in frequently, these communications that people engage in frequently. And one of the big theoretical reasons to care about this is that if the community is broadly connected, if people, you know, with the example that we looked at in Mexico, can still access substantial amounts of information from people in the United States over a long period of time through kind of strong network ties, that would suggest that migration to the U.S. could be facilitated for, you know, a lot longer than you would otherwise think. That if these ties are really durable and persistent, that the information about job opportunities and things like that in the destination can flow back to the origin in a way that could continue migration kind of like streams or flows, right? So a lot of the recent policy is sort of cracking down on aspects of immigration, making migrants more fearful of traveling back and forth and things like that. Our research suggests that those policies might affect the strength of ties that connect migrants to their origin communities, because one of the biggest findings that we have is that migrants who return home, even for kind of brief visits, really like keep the network alive, and that ties between migrants and family members back home are much stronger and much more durable when migrants return home just for a visit. And so to the extent that that might be declining, I think that that would have strong effects on sort of the connectivity that migrants maintain to kind of members of their origin community. The flip side of that, on the other hand, is that while that is a big impact on sort of the strength of ties between two individuals, we find that the network, even in the absence of that, is relatively robust for a long period of time to kind of this broader connectivity structure between not me and, you know, say my brother back home, but between the people I know here and the people my brother knows back home. Those structures, because of kind of redundancies in the network, actually remain pretty robust. So even if the individual ties kind of decline, the overall connectivity structure stays pretty strong, which suggests that there's still a lot of opportunity for information flow and other kinds of flows, remittances and things like that.
I was actually going to ask you about remittances. Is that something you've studied?
I haven't looked at remittances as directly as other people, but we've looked at it a little bit, and I know a bit about it from reading, but it's not a core topic of
mine. Yeah, I was just wondering if ties would remain strong. I mean, it seems like if you're supporting your mom back in the home country, that those ties would remain strong because you don't want your mom to go without food, kind
right.
of a thing.
It's both that, and then there's like a, you know, a pure coordination thing. The way I always think about it is remittances and kind of other things like that are sort of like a second level question. The first level is the tie still there? Because if you aren't in contact with someone, how do you send them money, right? So what we've mostly looked at is sort of these kind of first level contact and connectivity, communication frequency ties. And then I view kind of remittances and other activities like that as being sort of like a subset of those. Because without the contact and connectivity, it's very difficult to coordinate remittances, for instance.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Thanks. So you mentioned that basically the way that network data is collected means that you're not doing random sampling, and that creates some challenges. What are the largest methodological challenges that, in your opinion, are currently facing social network analysis research?
I think that there's three. The first is a tension between these sort of like snowball or referral-based sampling designs that I mentioned and sort of the random sampling literature. There are social network approaches that use kind of random sampling methods, but what they look at is just an individual and then their ties to, you know, their reports on ties to, you know, five people around them. And there's no ability to make those kind of broader connectivity structures. The sampling approach that I described, you can make kind of broader connectivity structures with that, sort of like a blended approach. And then there's a third approach where you survey, say, everyone in a school, and you ask them, who are you tied to? And then you sort of know, you really know everyone within that school, the connectivity structure. So there are some tensions between those methods. And I think an exciting area of development are the sampling approaches, which sort of blend the what's called the saturated network approach, where you survey everyone in the school, and the egocentric network approach, where you do like a random sample and ask about five friends for everyone. So I think that's an exciting area. I think one of the biggest methodological challenges is this idea of like causality and whether things are moving through networks in a causal way, particularly non-infections, but like ideas, information, and things like that. Are people's friends and peers changing their behavior, or are people selecting their friends and peers on the basis of like some behavior that those friends and peers have? And really separating this kind of influence idea that like your friends are making you do something, or even subconsciously, from like you're choosing types of people that accord with the things you were already going to do. This selection idea is one of the really thorny methodological issues for network analysis in general. I think that's probably the hardest one to solve. And the third big social network challenge right now is how to work with all of the new network data that is available, and really how to define like what ties are relevant. You know, with location tracking software and things like that, you can get data on, you know, we're in the same room, or we were right next to each other. And you could do that for many days and know who's next to each other and who's not. And there's some real challenges with taking the advantages of that big data stuff versus the kind of more traditional social network analysis stuff, which, you know, would go in and ask people, well, who do you spend your time with? And you'd write down, you know, five names. And really working between those two kind of approaches, I think, is going to lead to a lot of changes in how we kind of think about theoretical network issues as well as methodological issues, because they measure different things, like who you are near, you know, or who you say email a lot or something like that. These kind of digitally recorded interactions are meaningful in one way, but in another way, they might not be as meaningful because you don't think about it. You know, I probably email, you know, a budget person in my office more often than anyone else. But when you think of my academic collaborators, like clearly she's a very vital person to getting my work done, but not in terms of my scientific productivity regarding ideas and things like that. And so just looking at an email network, you might get a wrong perception of that. Similarly, like, you know, infrequent contact that is particularly meaningful might be, if you ask me who are the important collaborators I have, I might list them out. And some of them I might talk to less often than ones that, you know, if you were to look at my email that I email with or something like that. But what they say could be particularly weighty and weigh on my mind. So I think there's real challenges with like conceptual issues like that that need to be kind of integrated.
Yeah, those are really exciting. I mean, this is a methodology podcast, so I think it's exciting. I'm not sure what the listeners think, but yeah, if you guys could figure out causality, that's pretty... Yeah.
There are some exciting developments with it, you know, particularly with kind of randomized trial kind of approaches and stuff. There's a lot of very exciting stuff being done in kind of like the more marketing research stuff where they're testing randomized trials of like, you know, limiting people's apps, who it's shown to and things like that. And there was that Facebook study a while back that had some ethical issues with it and some methodological issues with measurement. But conceptually, things like that are pretty exciting. Similarly, like there's some actual real nice statistical advances being made too that are kind of using instrumental variable approaches and things like that are pretty exciting. Another methodological challenge is there have been a number of social network tools that have been developed and measures developed for sort of smaller networks with, you know, say 1,000 to 2,000 people or even fewer, and, you know, a certain, you know, 1,500 to 4,500 social network ties between the people. And then there's lots of data now which, you know, you can get 60,000 people's email network over a 12-month period. Sure. And so there are real challenges with dealing with time and how to kind of think about networks through time. And then there are challenges with kind of the methodological tools for the smaller network analysis are really appealing and have really great properties. And there's really nice ones for the larger network analysis, but the integration between those two is sometimes missing. And sort of my hobby horse, people, whenever you do anything with social networks, they always want to see the visualizations. Visualizations are like the most exciting thing for everyone who ever sees a network. You see the diagram of the connectivity between two communities, and it's very exciting. But often the visualizations are very challenging or don't work particularly well for the larger networks. And I think that's like one of those examples of challenges that visualizations look great in a small network, but in massive networks, it just looks like a yarn ball or something. So,
thank you. So your methodological work on network sampling methods has led you to two research projects that on some level appear very different. In one, you're studying the heroin crisis here in Pennsylvania. And in the other, you are trying to reduce racial disparities in kidney transplants. Can you talk about these two projects and how they pose different challenges in terms of social network analysis?
Yeah, you know, I think there are people that are sort of like dependent variable people, and they're interested in outcomes in particular. And then there are sort of like independent variable people that are interested in like particular explanations for phenomena that might be diverse, diverse set of outcomes. And so I guess I always thought of myself more as like a explanations person or something. And I think that the social networks kind of approach really is very helpful for understanding both of these phenomena, because who we interact with and turn to in times of need and things like that are really fundamentally vital questions that determine both like how we access treatment, how we stay in treatment for heroin users, but also who kidney transplant candidates go to when they're trying to find a suitable donor to help them or to donate a kidney or be evaluated to donate a kidney. And so I think that's really kind of the same question in both, is like, how do we access the people we know? How do we make decisions about, of all the possible people we could turn to, how do we make these decisions? And what kind of features of the relationship or of the two individuals themselves lead to people seeking out those people versus others and lead to particularly successful versions of those? In the kidney transplant candidate literature, for instance, you know, a very successful strategy, if you just were to look at like the data and just ignore the social relations and just say, all right, people will ask their family members who would be the best people to ask. Theoretically, it would probably be their nieces and nephews, because overall, nieces and nephews are younger than you, they're healthier than you, and you have usually a lot of them, because if you have, you know, two siblings and they each have two kids, you have several of those. People don't turn to their nieces and nephews at all. Like, they're very rarely the ones that are asked to help donate a kidney. People are much more likely to turn to their spouse, who is the single, in some ways, theoretically, the single worst person you could ask, because your spouse is most similar to you in age and health behaviors and is not a genetic match. So there's kind of interesting ways that you can look at these kind of relations and see like, oh, that's sort of a non-optimal strategy, but are there ways that we could reorient it? And this is the purpose of our grant, is to think, well, people are most likely to turn to their spouse. Their spouse is often not qualified to donate to them. Are there ways that we can sort of talk to them and figure out ways that they could talk to, say, other people like their siblings, that they have bonds similar to what they have with their spouse? And just like in the heroin network data, we're really looking at who people go to and how their drug use has affected their networks over time. And the results are pretty staggering if you look at it. It's just this real collapse in support for people from when they start using drugs to as they go over time. They lose a lot of the connections to people that don't use drugs, and their networks become much smaller, much more localized, and primarily other individuals that use drugs and former users. And so from our results, it looks like sort of entering kind of this world that is very densely saturated with drug users, which I think can be a challenge for seeking treatment and maintaining recovery once you've recovered.
Yeah, if your whole social network is still using heroin, very, very difficult to be out there clean and alone.
Yeah. And this is anecdotally, to me, it's roughly knowing, I think Alcoholics Anonymous and the kind of other organizations have actually for a long time kind of exploited these ideas without maybe actually explicitly measuring them. But a big part of that is they sort of reorient you into a kind of treatment culture where you're working with a lot of other people who are also rehabbing and dealing with the challenges of that. And you often are kind of not necessarily cutting off, but reducing contact with people that are still using. And so there are some kind of anecdotal evidence that kind of successful treatment programs might be using ideas like this. We're just measuring with opioid users.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, Ashton, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun to be here.
You have been listening to Methodology Minutes. Please visit methodology.psu.edu for podcasts, software, reading lists, and more.